interview recorded on 20 September 2011. In these interviews, we speak with personalities in the domain of human-computer interaction with ideas that deserve a closer look. My name is Johannes van der Meulen of Naman, and today we have Dr. Frans de Waal. He's here to prove that the human-computer interaction discipline likes to look beyond its confines. Dr. Frans de Waal is a Dutch-American biologist and primatologist known for his work on the behavior and social intelligence of primates. His first book, Chimpanzee Politics, this was 1982, compared the schmoozing and scheming of chimpanzees involved in power struggles with that of human politicians. His scientific work has been published in hundreds of technical articles and journals such as Science, Nature, Scientific American, and outlets specialized in animal behavior. His popular books, translated into many languages, have made him one of the world's most visible primatologists. His latest books are Our Inner Ape, 2005, and The Age of Empathy, 2009. Dr. de Waal is the C.H. Candler Professor in the Psychology Department of Emory University and also Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Center in Atlanta, Georgia. He's been elected to the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences. In 2007, he was selected by Time as one of the world's 100 most influential people today, and in 2011 by Discover as among 47 all-time great minds of science. Dr. Well, thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
Your most recent book, The Age of Empathy, provides a lot of amazing examples of animal pro-social behavior, helping, thanking for help delivered. It was a humpback whale, I think. Grief, elephants. Trust, monkeys. Reciprocity by chimps. How is it important for us to know and understand this kind of pro-social behavior?
Well, it's in a way, it's important to understand animals, but it's also important for ourselves. We are, after all, animals, and that's sort of like the basic message of my books is that we humans, we have a tendency to look at all the things that we do from a uniquely human angle, and so we think morality is uniquely human, politics, whatever. But I want to, in my book, explain the connection, and at the same time that I explain the connection between human and animal behavior, I show that things that humans do are maybe a bit more simple, a bit simpler than we think, and things that animals do are maybe a bit more complex than we think.
Empathy is an important theme of the book, of course. And is it so that we need something more than empathy, such as something like institutions or religion or politics, to hold our complex society together?
Oh yeah, we nowadays we live in societies that are so complex, like we have millions of people organized in nations and all of this. But of course, humanity started in small communities, most likely communities of 100 people or maybe 200 people, who were sometimes at war with each other, but most of the time probably not. I don't think warfare was as important in our history as people claim. But it was small community life. And so in our present-day societies, you have all sorts of other challenges. But the funny thing is that all these basic capacities that we have, social capacities like empathy or a sense of fairness or whatever the capacity is, all of them still play a dominant role. And even in these big societies, they're very important.
Yes. And is the requirement for empathy, will the requirement for empathy grow with the increasing density of cities, for example? Imagine that we are 10 billion people or 15 billion people. How is that going to play, do you think?
Well, that's the big challenge, I think, of our time, is actually to live together with people who are different from you, which is happening in all the big cities, like a city like Brussels or Toronto or New York. You have to live with people who are quite different from you. They look different, they talk different, they dress different, they eat different. And to extend empathy to them is a bit of a challenge, because our makeup as humans, and this is the same for animals, animal empathy is very biased. It's biased towards the in-group and towards individuals that you know. And human empathy is exactly like that. Human, in all the tests that have been done with humans, humans find it much easier to empathize with individuals that they know or that are like them.
Let's talk briefly about technology. I know it's not a theme of your research, but still, I may ask the question that, as a biologist, how do you look at current technologies? Is it just sticks and stones to the extreme, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, so human technology started, of course, with sticks and stones. And the sticks were not preserved, and that's why humans attach so much importance to the stone part, because the sticks and the wood tools and the wood ornaments and whatever we had did not preserve in the fossil record. But chimpanzees, for example, they have what we call a technology, and actually recently a nutcracking site was discovered in the forest, which has all the signs of a chimpanzee nutcracking site, but it's 4,000 years old, and it was excavated exactly the same way they do with humans. And so chimpanzees have an old technology, stone technology, just like humans do. Now, if you look at the current technology, the electronics that you probably all work with, that has taken things to a completely different level, because now the tools are not just a simple extension that you use to crack nuts or to reach something that is out of reach, but has become a communication tool. And I don't think there's any tools in the animal kingdom that, except maybe drumming on a drum or things like that, but there's nothing that really is a communication tool, I think.
And do you think that these technologies have the potential to exploit our natural tendency to share, to cooperate, to reciprocate?
Yeah, because they tie into human nature. They have to. So for example, the social networks that we have, like Facebook and so on, that ties into social needs that we have. And those social needs are very ancient. They're much older than the technology.
So would they increase the range of empathy?
I'm not sure that they add to empathy. I think the big challenge of our time is to empathize beyond the borders of our little groups.
In your book, you state the body first theory, where, if I understood correctly, the emotions of others affect our body first, and then the emotions mm-hmm. follow. How did you arrive there from your work with primates?
Well, I think in many animals, that's the channel that they have for empathy is a body channel, is that they reach your emotions, like your dog, for example, reach your emotions in response to your emotions, but it's all mediated by the body. It's not because he hears you describe a certain situation, like humans can empathize with that also, but I think the body language is the first. And in young children, that's very clearly the case. So for example, children already, when they're younger than 2 years, they already have forms of empathy. And no one would say that they have some sort of cognitive construction where they try to put themselves in the shoes of somebody else. They don't have the capacity for that.
Primacy of the body is what you said.
Yeah, and I'm saying that partly also because in psychology, the dominant view of empathy for a long time was a cognitive view. It was the view that you would hear someone describe his situation, you would imagine yourself in that situation, and that's how you arrive at empathy. Until there was a psychologist in Sweden who started doing experiments with faces. He would project faces subliminally to people, so too short for them to know that they saw the faces. These people, they thought they were looking at landscapes, but actually they saw faces in between. And if he showed them happy faces, the people felt better afterwards. If he showed them sad faces, they felt worse afterwards. And so he showed that empathy is an unconscious process. And people didn't accept it at the time. It was all his papers were rejected. And now it's the dominant view, actually, that's the way things go.
You see a causal link between the human exceptionalism of the Judeo-Christian religions, where humans see themselves as very distinct from animals, not as an animal, really. And the fact that these religions originated among desert-dwelling nomadic tribes, what's the link between, you know, these religions originating from desert dwelling?
Well, in the desert, people did not have primates, except for maybe Hamadryas, baboons, and Egypt. They probably knew about those. But for the rest, people had goats and camels and snakes and scorpions, and they didn't have a lot of animals that looked like them. And so the connection between human and animal, it's easy to maintain that we are totally different from animals, as the only, if the only animals you're dealing with are camels. And so in the East, in China and India and Japan, they had monkeys and they had even apes in some places. And so they had a very different connection with nature. They knew that there were animals who looked exactly like them.
How was your work received in various quarters, maybe scientific disciplines, but also countries, continents? Do you see a clear difference there?
Yeah, there's some interesting differences. So in the US, we have to deal with the creationists. I almost never have, even though I live in the South, I almost never have interactions with them. I think it's a sort of self-selected audience what I get. I don't get the creationists coming to my talk. So that would be in the US. In France, it's interesting, you're very close to Paris here, but France is filled with philosophers who believe that humans are totally exceptional. And even though they don't proclaim themselves to be Christian, it's a very Christian type of thinking, like humans have minds and animals are just instinct machines, very Cartesian, in fact. And so, each country has its own way of looking at things. For example, the Germans are still very nervous about biology and humans for historical reasons. Buddhists or the Japanese, they have absolutely no problem. They see all sorts of connections between humans and animals. And so, each country has a different response to things.
Yeah, because it does reach deep into our beliefs about who we are, where we come from. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book on religion and morality. And actually, my lecture tonight will be on that topic also.
You don't shy away from politics. Are bonobos Democrats and are chimps Republicans?
Well, some people have speculated like that. It seems like that because bonobos are more hippie-like and sexually free than the chimpanzees, who are more dominance-oriented and territorial. But it's, of course, it's a bit of a simplification because bonobos have fights too, and chimpanzees cooperate also. Actually, we did a very interesting study on cooperation in chimpanzees recently. And so it's a bit of a black and white. It's a bit like men are from Mars and women are from Venus type of, you know, distinction, which is a bit too sharp, really, you know.
And why interest in religion? Because, you know, as far... apes do not have religion, do they?
No, I don't think they do. No, but religion is, in humans, religion and morality are tied together. And so even if you are an atheist in present-day society, in let's say Belgium, your morality is still shaped by the whole Christian history, whatever you do. And so morality and religion are sort of tied together, and it's very interesting to speculate how that happened. I personally think that morality is older than religion. It's not God who invented morality for us or God who ordained how you should behave. It's more the other way around. As we developed the moral system, and at some point we put God in charge and said he's going to handle it for us. And of course, then the atheists don't believe that that happened.
Well, yeah, and there is something in that all the religions have in common, the golden rule: treat your neighbor as you want to be treated yourself, basically.
Yeah.
The reciprocity.
That's a very, very questionable rule, the golden rule. I know it's a popular way of summarizing moral systems, but moral systems don't really work by that kind of rules. So, for example, just a funny example. Let's say I meet a very beautiful woman in the evening in the hotel. I jump in her bed unasked, uninvited. And she says, well, what are you doing here? And she gets angry or whatever. And I say, well, I'm doing unto you the sort of thing that I would like you to do to me, which is the golden rule applied to this woman here. That would not go over so well, I think. So the golden rule has a lot of exceptions. And the exceptions of the golden rule come about because not all humans are 100% identical. Humans have different interests. So, for example, if I serve meat to a vegetarian because I would like them to serve me meat, which would be the golden rule, they would not be happy. So the golden rule has lots of exceptions, and I would not go on a moral system by rules. I don't think that's how we decide moral things.
Well, this is a funny one. I don't know what you can answer, but why does tickling not work on oneself?
I don't know. Tickling works on apes, you know. You can tickle apes. And they have the same tickling spots under the armpits, in the belly. They laugh also. There's not so many animals you can tickle. So, for example, a dog, you can try to tickle. Well, of course, you can play with a dog and roll him around and stuff like that if he likes you. But tickling is not exactly what you can do with a dog. But with apes, you can do that. I don't know why tickling yourself doesn't work now. Because it's a social thing. Yeah.